intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant?
Dare to think out loud.
You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded.
Dare to think out loud.
You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren.
Dare to think out loud.
You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history.
Dare to think out loud.
You have tuned in to the right show.
Dare to think out loud.
Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Okay, let's see if you're on the air now. I'll go in the chat room and see if they can hear us.
I've still got dead air.
Okay. Okay, so I just want to see if the chat room can hear us.
Okay.
Well, they can't hear us if you don't talk, Scorpio.
Well, I just did. I was just...
I saw you type.
They can hear us. They can hear us, so go ahead, Mike. Go ahead. You're on.
Right on.
Oh, they can hear us?
Yes, right, sir. Folks. Go ahead. You're on.
Well, pardon me. I wasn't hearing anything at all. And so, folks, we are here today with... Dare to talk out loud. So, or dare to think out loud. Either one of the two will do, and kind of got a little disjointed there with the beginning, but we'll jump right into it. Got with me today my friend Cal from out there in Arizona country. How you doing today, Cal?
Doing good, Mike. Doing good. Just, you know, got a cooling trend. We're only hitting 115 today.
Oh, only 115. You better get out to parka, buddy.
Pretty much.
could be you suffer frostbite here in no time at all. And
yeah.
Dave, how are things down there south of the equator? And are you ready to come north yet?
Yes, I will be leaving here in about 1 month, even a little bit less.
We're looking forward to having you back here, buddy.
Yes,
truly
I'm
are.
Everything up, Mike.
Yeah, I just noticed today that we have people... I saw a headline that people who have been vaccinated are dying from COVID. How's that happen again?
Well, Mike, I'll give you a firsthand story. I was at the dentist yesterday, and my dentist, an Ecuadorian, told me that her nephew died 2 weeks after taking the shot, 35 years old.
And did he die of COVID or die from the shot? Or do we know? How will we know the difference?
Well, they're not going to tell us. The medical profession will not tell stories like that. But obviously, he died of the shot. He was perfectly healthy, 35 years old, died within 2 weeks of taking the shot. Some kind of heart-related problem.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, it's called poison in the heart. But anyway, Dave, it's good to have you on. Could you tell the folks how they can help keep Freedom Slips Radio going here, my friend?
Yes, Mike. Well, as everyone knows, freedom of speech is under attack all over the world. And freedom of speech is the most important thing we have. And Revolution Radio stands alone as a true bastion of free speech. So if you're listening out there and you like what you hear, you know, come aboard freedomslips.com. That's freedomslips.com. And show what value this station brings to your life. You know, become a Patreon member, or come on revolution.radio. That's the other site, and become a Patreon member and donate something every month. And just remember, all of the money goes just to keep the servers going and the station going. The hosts are not paid, neither are the managers. So all expenses go to keeping the station going. So come aboard and help us out. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Appreciate that, my friend. And let's jump into the discussion here. And today we have, Cal and I have decided to discuss and talk about two people in American history who are seldom, if ever, heard from. And I believe one of the greatest sins of our public school system has been the lie of omission. Now, they're really good at the lie of commission, but the lie of omission is unreal. Why are we not taught about the anti-federalist? Why are we not taught about the people who totally oppose this Constitution and why they oppose the Constitution? And of course, they couldn't just totally ignore Patrick Henry. So they just say, oh, he's wonderful. And people who, David Barton says, oh, he was responsible for the Constitution in so many ways, which is a total fabrication. And it's just amazing the way that they pervert history to support the government. That should be the people's first clue about this mess. Is if you have to lie to support the government, what does that tell you about the government you're lying to support? Cal, you got any thoughts on that, buddy?
No, I agree with that. It's like, why isn't, you know, the whole story being told to the American people in history? If you don't have the whole story, then what you actually have is just mythology. And that's what everybody's learned, is American mythology, not American history.
Well, do you remember that great lie of Fox News when they first started, when they first got brought on the air, that great lie when they said, we report, you decide?
Yeah, that was a pretty good one. That was a big lie.
Well, that's a pretty good hook to catch a fish on, don't you think? You get the people who think that the press is left wing and there's a left wing media. There is not a left wing media. There's not a right wing media. There is a government media. And this left wing media didn't oppose George W. Bush's war with Iraq. As a matter of fact, they helped fabricate the lies to try to justify it. So it's kind of hard to convince people that it's a left-wing media when they support anybody and everybody that's of the government, in the government viewpoint, and that is actually a member of the government. But today, we kind of wanted to focus on two guys, and these two guys are none other than William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee. And so I don't remember studying those people in history. Dave, you did some college history classes. Do you remember Grayson or Richard Henry Lee being mentioned?
Absolutely not, no.
Well, we know Richard Henry Lee had to be a racist just because of his last name. So, that may be the reason we weren't told about Richard Henry Lee. But one of the things I wanted to bring about with William Grayson first was what he, part of a speech that he made at the Virginia Ratification Convention. And let's remember that the Federalists, the so-called Federalists, monarchist, nationalist, empire builders, they wanted to push the Constitution on the people. And so they thought the best way to do that was to tell the people how terrible the circumstances were and how everything was about to happen that was going to be terrible against them if they didn't get rid of those darned Articles of Confederation and get a government with more energy. Now, when anytime someone in government talks about energy, they're talking about oppression, people. They're talking about having the power to stomp on you and take your money. That is an energetic government. The last thing you want in your life is an energetic government. But that was what they pitched it on. But Grayson, here is part of Grayson's speech. And he said, and I quote, "The adoption of this government will not ameliorate our own particular system. I beg leave to consider the circumstances of the Union antecedent to the meeting of the convention at Philadelphia. We have been told of phantoms and ideal dangers to lead us unto measures which will, in my opinion, be the ruin of our country. If the existence of those dangers cannot be proved, if there be no apprehension of wars, if there be no rumors of wars, it will place the subject in a different light and plainly evince to the world that there cannot be any reason for adopting measures which we apprehend to be ruinous and destructive. When this state proposed that the general government should be improved, Massachusetts was just recovered from a rebellion which had brought the republic to the brink of destruction, from a rebellion which was crushed by that federal government, which is now so much condemned and abhorred. A vote of that august body for 1,500 men, aided by the exertions of the state, silenced all opposition and shortly restored the public tranquility. Massachusetts was satisfied that these internal commotions were so happily settled and was unwilling to risk any similar distresses by theoretic experiments. Were the eastern states willing to enter into this measure? Were they willing to accede to the proposal of Virginia? In what manner was it received? Connecticut revolted at the idea. The eastern states, sir, were unwilling to recommend a meeting of a convention. They were well aware of the dangers of revolutions and changes. Why was every effort used and such uncommon pains taken to bring it about? This would have been unnecessary had it been approved by the people. Was Pennsylvania disposed for the reception of this project of reformation? No, sir. She was even willing to amend her revenue laws so as to make the 5% operative. She was satisfied with things as they were. There was no complaint that ever I heard of from any other part of the Union except Virginia. This being the case among ourselves, what dangers were there to be apprehended from foreign nations? It will be easily shown that dangers from that quarter were absolutely imaginary. Was not France friendly? Unequivocally so. She was devising new regulations of commerce to our advantage. Did she harass us with applications for her money? Is it likely that France will quarrel with us? Is it not reasonable to suppose that she will be more desirous than ever to cling, after losing the Dutch Republic, to her best ally? How are the Dutch? We owe them money, it is true. And are they not willing that we should owe them more? Mr. John Adams applied to them for a new loan to the poor, despised Confederation. They readily granted that loan. The Dutch have a fellow feeling for us. They are in the same situation with ourselves." So, and the title of his presentation was, you know, "We Have Been Told of Phantoms." Well, he pretty well destroys that without much of contention, I will promise you. So then we have, you know, Richard Henry Lee, who, by the way, was one of the delegates selected to attend the Constitutional Convention from Virginia. But he was in the Congress at that time And he was like I said, a member of that Congress, but he was also ill at the time he was selected. So he turned down his appointment to the Constitutional Convention because of his ill health at the time. Of course, I'm sure he didn't know that the convention was going to last 4 months. But anyway, he turned it down and he stayed in New York City so he could attend the meetings of Congress. And also, Patrick Henry was selected from Virginia, but Henry just completely turned his down because he said he smelt a rat in Philadelphia leaning toward a monarchy. How prescient was that comment? But Richard Henry Lee wrote anti-federalist papers under the name The Federal Farmer. Now, there has been, and especially came up in the 1970s, there were a group of people in the 1970s who said that Richard Henry Lee was not the author of the Federal Farmer essays. And they said it didn't fit his style. They offered their proof of it wasn't his style, but they couldn't offer any proof that it wasn't him, other than their contention about the style of the letters. And also, they couldn't provide who it might be. So today, the Lee family still holds to the position that Richard Henry Lee was, in fact, the author of The Federal Farmer. And I'm going to read you part of what he had to say, which will coincide with what William Grayson had to say about the convention. And so in his first letter to The Republican, which was a newspaper, Richard Henry Lee said, and I quote, "My letters to you last winter on the subject of a well-balanced national government for the United States were the result of free inquiry. When I passed from that subject to inquiries relative to our commerce, revenues, past administration, etc., I anticipated the anxieties I feel on carefully examining the plan of government proposed by the convention. It appears to be a plan retaining some federal features, but to be the first important step and to aim strongly to one consolidated government of the United States. It leaves the powers of government and the representation of the people so unnaturally divided between the general and state governments that the operations of our system must be very uncertain. My uniform federal attachments and the interest I have in the protection of property and a steady execution of the laws will convince you that I am under any bias at all. If I am under any bias at all, it is in favor of any general system which shall promise these advantages. The instability of our laws increases my wishes for firm and steady government, but then I can consent to no government, which in my opinion is not calculated equally to preserve the rights of all orders of men in the community. My object has been to join with those who have endeavored to supply the defects in the forms of our government by a steady and proper administration of them. Though I have long apprehended that fraudulent debtors," he mentions fraudulent debtors. We'll have to get into that. "And embarrassed men on the one hand and men on the other, unfriendly to Republican equality, would produce an uneasiness among the people and prepare the way not for cool and deliberate reforms in the government, but for changes calculated to promote the interest of particular orders of men. Acquit me, sir, of any agency in the formation of the new system. I shall be satisfied with seeing, if it shall be adopted, a prudent administration. Indeed, I am so much convinced of the truth of Pope's maxim that which is best administered is best, that I am much inclined to subscribe to it from experience. I am not disposed to unreasonably contend about forms. I know our situation is critical and it behooves us to make the best of it. A federal government of some sort is necessary. We have suffered the present to languish, and whether the Confederation was capable or not originally of answering any valuable purposes, it is now but of little importance. I will pass by the men and the states who have been particularly instrumental in preparing the way for a change and perhaps for governments not very favorable to the people at large. A constitution is now presented which we may reject, or which we may accept, with or without amendments. and to which point we ought to direct our exertions is the question. To determine this question with propriety, we must attentively examine the system itself and the probable consequences of either step. This I shall endeavor to do, so far as I am able, with candor and fairness, and leave you to decide upon the propriety of my opinions, the weight of my reasons, and how far my conclusions are well drawn. Whatever may be the conduct of others on the present occasion, I do not mean, hastily and positively, to decide on the merits of the Constitution proposed. I shall be open to conviction and always disposed to adopt that which, all things considered, shall appear to me to be the most for the happiness of the community. It must be granted that if men hastily and blindly adopt a system of government, they will as hastily and as blindly be led to alter or abolish it, and changes must ensue one after another till the peaceable and better part of the community will grow weary with changes, tumults, and disorders, and be disposed to accept any government, however despotic, that shall promise stability and firmness. Well, I'm going to stop reading at that point, at least for a little while. But here's what I like about Richard Henry Lee. He is open to any change. He doesn't have a preset agenda that he is following. Now, he mentions that there are some problems, but he and William Grayson both get into what those problems are, and they bring up the fact that these problems which the country faced were the problems that any country would face after being in a war for 7 or 8 years. There was going to be problems. Naturally, there were going to be problems because the whole country had been at war. There had been a war taking place. Think about what it was like in the South after the Civil War. There had been a war going on for 8 years. Men had not been at a job. They had been out fighting. So naturally, there were problems, and those problems could be taken care of. But in another book that I was just reading a week or so ago was the opinions by many that the country was in fantastic shape, even with because they were recovering from the issues of the war. John Adams said that every man in America who wants a job has one. Well, does that sound bad? Everyone who has a job wants one. Thomas Jefferson, when he first arrived back from France, talked about how well the country was doing. Robert Livingston, who was the head of the Secretary of the Congress, talked about the conditions in America were fantastic, probably the best they'd been, even before the war. George Washington commented on it, how great things were going. So if we take this all into consideration, what was the push for a new constitution? And I think we're going to find that the push for a new constitution had to do with the fact that the western lands, everything west of the Alleghenies and the Appalachians, was now being inhabited by people in large numbers. That represented a threat to the commerce of the eastern seaboard. And the first thing they tried to do was to get John Jay to sign a treaty with Gardaqui of Spain that would have prohibited any trade on the Mississippi River for 30 years. That was what the Eastern Seaboard, the states of the Eastern Seaboard, wanted to do to curtail this movement, which would have taken away from their trade centers. Because if they could have traded, if the people moving west of the mountain ranges could have begun to trade up and down the Mississippi River, the East Coast was going to lose a lot of trade. A lot of the people, especially in Philadelphia, who were heavily invested in the commercial enterprises, were all at the Constitutional Convention. All 8 delegates from Pennsylvania were from Philadelphia. The rest of the state was not represented. That, and all of them were involved in the commercial interests of Philadelphia. It's such an easy thing to see through if the people would just take the time to do so. Cal, you have any comments, my friend?
Well, In reviewing both of them, you know, we have phantom problems. And one of them, you know, is they're saying, you know, well, we could be invaded by foreigners. And both Grayson and Lee are both are federal farmer are saying that, no, we can't. I mean, look at France. They're not, they're on our side already. They're not being really clamorous about us paying back their debt. So, you know, and the foreign debt's being paid. The same thing with the Dutch. I mean, not only was the debt being paid, the Dutch were willing to lend even more money. So there was no problem with the debt. So it's with foreign debt. And there was no problem with being invaded or being at war with another country. And so what was brought up was, well, there seems to be a problem with this domestic debt from, as you were pointing out, these people within the country. Wait, these are the same people where there's a problem at that are the ones that are proposing a new government as well. So the people who created the problem to create a new government and use that as an excuse. And that's what I'm getting from all of this, is pointing out that the only problem is the domestic debt created by the Federalists to pay the Federalists. So the whole Constitution and the whole scam or the whole scheme or the whole crafting of it was about them getting control and taking control of Western lands and the money and everything else that comes from land, because all wealth originates from land. That's what I get from it.
Okay. Dave, you have any
thoughts? Am I off on that or?
No, Cal, I think you're spot on, buddy.
Okay. Yeah, no, I just completely agree with what Cal said. You know, and most importantly, all wealth originates from land. That is so absolutely true.
And also, I believe that so many of these people who were at the Constitutional Convention were also land speculators, Washington being one of the chief land speculators, along with Robert Morris and others who were at this convention, and they wanted to be involved. Washington was already involved in a company that was selling these Western lands or purchasing for sale these Western lands that had recently come about. And Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson mentioned that these sales of these Western lands would be more than enough to pay off all the debts which the country owed. So if that is the case, why the rush for a new constitution except to give the people in commerce and in the legal profession dominion and control over everybody? It's just so hard to understand why it wouldn't be that way. But jumping back to Richard Henry Lee, if I may here, and I quote, "Nothing but the passions of ambitious, impatient, or disorderly men, I conceive, will plunge us into commotions if time should be taken fully to examine and consider the system proposed. Men who feel easy in their circumstances, and such are not sanguine in their expectations relative to the consequences of the proposed change, will remain quiet under the existing governments. Many commercial and moneyed men who are uneasy, not without just cause, ought to be respected, and by no means unreasonably disappointed in their expectations and hopes. But as to those who expect employments under this new constitution, as to those weak and ardent men who always expect to be gainers by revolutions, and whose lot it generally is to get out of one difficulty into another, they are very little to be regarded. And as to those who designedly avail themselves of this weakness and ardor, they are to be despised. It is natural for men who wish to hasten the adoption of a measure to tell us now is the crisis. Now is the critical moment which must be seized or all will be lost, and to shut the door against free inquiry whenever conscious the thing presented has defects in it, which time and investigation will soon discover. This has been the custom of tyrants and their dependents in all ages. If it is true, what has been so often said, that the people of this country cannot change their condition for the worse, I presume it still behooves them to endeavor deliberately to change it for the better." The fickle and ardent in many community are the proper tools for establishing despotic government. But if it is deliberate and thinking men who must establish and secure governments on free principles before they decide on the plan proposed, they will inquire whether it will probably be a blessing or a curse to the people. So, ironically, Richard Henry Lee makes a point, Cal, which I would like for us to discuss. Richard Henry Lee says there were about 7 or 8 people who he referred to as being of strong Republican convention. Now, what he meant by Republican is not the Republican Party of today. He meant that these were people who had a strong belief in a Republican form of government. And so that was what he said, that there were maybe 7 or 8 of these people who just absolutely did not attend the convention for one reason or another. Now, we know 74 were invited, only 59 showed up. Invited or selected. So those who didn't show up, and he doesn't name them, I wish he would have, but Richard Henry Lee said, if those men of this strong Republican conviction would have shown up at the Constitutional Convention, he thought the outcome would have been much different. What do you think about that, Cal?
I agree. I mean, the whole convention would have been different if someone like Patrick Henry would have been there. Even if Richard Henry Lee could have been there, it would have been different. Just because they stuck to the principles of liberty and not the principles of government. I mean, it was even admitted amongst the anti-federalists that, yeah, there's some problems with the Articles of Confederation, but they're not these big, huge, gigantic problems you guys are trying to make it out to be. And they can be solved. And we can, you know, take them one step at a time and work on it. You know, I mean, but there was no plan to fix the Articles. It wasn't the intention of the Federalists, because the Articles would always restrict them in one way or another from doing everything they wanted to do, and namely being the 13th article of the Articles of Confederation, the unanimity clause.
Well, there are, I thought about this, and I thought about what if, you know, and you and I have done the what if game over and over on many occasions, Cal, but I have thought, what if Richard Henry Lee was at the convention? What if Patrick Henry had gone to the convention? And these other gentlemen that he doesn't name who just didn't go. And of course, we have no idea why they didn't go, because Patrick Henry was one of the only ones who stated why he wasn't going. But what if Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, and a few other people had been there? Would Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr., Luther Martin, and John Francis Mercer have left in disgust if they would have seen that they had cohorts there with them that were willing to fight for the principles they believed in?
I was just going to bring that up. If they'd have gone, then those men you just mentioned might have stayed and would have had more influence over the proceedings of the convention. I mean, they would have had more influence and helped bolster support of others, like even Mason and Jerry, you know, who were somewhat towards a not as strong anti-federalist, but would have helped them maintain their so-called Republican principles. And yeah, it's important to understand what they mean by Republican principles, as opposed to a Republican form of government. They're two different things. Republican principles are all about preserving liberty, and a Republican government is all about representation, and they're not the same. So when the founders talked about Republican principles, they're talking about preserving rightful liberty and what it takes to do that.
Well, doggone it, Cal, you bring up something. What does it take to constitute a Republican form of government? What are the principles? You know, we use these phrases so many times, and I'm not sure I totally understand at times what it meant to be a proponent of a Republican form of government. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are just tuning in to learning about this who don't have a clue what it meant by Republican form of government. So are you aware of the what steps or what ideals it takes to constitute a Republican form of government?
Well, the main thing about a Republican form of government is republic is representative, which means you have somebody represent you. So in order for someone to represent you, you have to stay within a certain size or scale, because as it is now, you have one representative for 750,000 plus people. And there is no way that one person can represent that many people. So you, in order to have a proper representative or Republican government, you're going to have small governments. I mean, the city of Manhattan alone is too big to be a Republican form of government. You'd have to break it down into each borough just to even come close to having what a true Republican or representative form of government would be. It would, and in a Republican form of government, as the population grows, it wouldn't consolidate. It would continually break down into smaller and smaller. It would continually want to break down into smaller forms of government. And that's what a Republican form of government is. And that's how the only way you can preserve liberty as a group like that through a government is to continually decentralize the government, not centralize it.
Well, you know,
that's how I understand it. Am I explaining it wrong? I mean, that's that follows natural law. I mean, if you're a family, you know, you raise your kids, they grow up, they don't stay in your home, they move out and form their own little republic, so to speak. And then you have grandkids and they form their own little republic. And that's how nature intends things to grow. And so since government's supposed to follow natural law, it would seem to me that governments instituted among men should also follow that natural law, so that once it gets to a certain size, it just breaks off. I mean, they break off. They're not your enemies. I mean, my family's not my enemy. I mean, family lives somewhere else. They're their own little republic. I go to visit them. They come to visit me. It doesn't make them my enemy. It doesn't make somebody who's not in my republic an enemy of mine. I'm willing to trade with them. I'm willing to deal with them. It takes a whole different mindset in looking at what government is. And, you know, that's what these guys were looking at.
Well, I think that was a great explanation and a great description, Cal. But in my research, I found out that there are seven basic principles which are necessary to constitute a Republican form of government. Now, let's not forget that Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution as ratified stipulates that the federal government shall provide to every state a Republican form of government. Okay, now this is critical. The federal government is supposed to provide to the states this form of government. Now, here are the seven principles. Number one, there is a strict separation of powers, horizontally as well as vertically. Okay, we could get into a lot of detail on that one. Perhaps we will a bit later on. Number two, the government is run by officers governing for a short term only, and only during good behavior. Ooh. Number three, offices are selected by our election, and no offices are to be filled by appointments by the government itself. Damn. Number four, the government recognizes that power resides originally in the people as they receive it immediately from God. Then, number five,
there is a deliberativeness in action, and that it is, by the checks and balances, not subject to the whimsical fancy of a minority. Number six, the government acknowledges the final right of the people to alter or abolish it whenever it usurps the rights for which it was instituted by the people to administer God's law. Number seven, the government does not grant entitlements because it is powerless to do so. There's the seven, people. Now,
well, obviously this government doesn't qualify as a republic then.
Well, none of the states do either, Cal.
No, none of the county or city governments do either.
But Article 4, Section 4 states that the federal government must provide to each state a republican form of government. People, if you want to see how the federal government is totally out of control and totally operating outside of the Constitution, you only need one clause. Article 4, Clause 4. It's right there. So very, very, very simple. And Cal, thanks, you know, because I hadn't prepared to bring these 7 points in, but they pop up and I was happy to have them to where I could find them.
Well, I'm glad you had those to show that this isn't a republic.
Exactly.
It's not a federation either.
No, it's far from a federation. Dave, you have any thoughts, my friend?
Well, again, I think Cal touched on the heart of the issue here too, which is decentralization. I think that's the most, you know, as bad as government is, the closer, you know, the government is to the people they actually have power over, the better. When you have, you know, people in Washington, D.C. that are completely disconnected from the rest of the country, they don't give a damn what happens. They're in their own little world. If your government and the people in it live close by you, they're a lot more accountable just by, you know, essential human nature. So decentralization is the key for, I think it's our way out of all these problems. Centralization of power will always lead to totalitarianism every time. It's a lot harder to do if that person is your neighbor. So I think that's one of the keys, absolutely.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. But I wanted to drop back to something where we were talking about how the Federalists said that we were in such a dire strait in both Grayson and, pardon me, both Grayson and Richard Henry Lee addressed that. But I wanted to bring up these quotes as well. And we were told by these Federalists the disasters of economics and commerce, which necessitated a departure from the Articles of Confederation and the adoption of an entirely new constitution of greater energy back in 1787. Ironically, just the opposite was stated by George Washington, Charles Thompson, Secretary of the Congress since 1774, and Robert Livingston of New York. Now, what did George Washington say publicly? And I quote, "Our internal state governments are duly acquiring strength. The laws have their fullest energy. Justice was well administered. Robbery, violence, or murder is not heard of from New Hampshire to Georgia. The people at large are more industrious than they were before the war. Houses are being rebuilt. Fields enclosed. Stocks of cattle which were destroyed are being replaced. The foundation of a great empire is laid, and Providence will not leave its goal imperfect." That's what Washington said. But then in his letters to the Federalists, he's talking about they got to do something because everything's in such a turmoil. Oh, Washington the politician. And Charles Thompson, the Secretary of Congress, in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, of all people, said that he would venture to assert that there is not upon the face of the earth a body of people more happy or rising into consequence with more rapid strides than the inhabitants of the United States of America. that sound like we're in a lot of trouble, people? And then Robert Livingston of New York, one of the leaders of the political arm in New York, said, and I quote, "The best criterion for the state of trade is that the commodities and labors of the country still bear a better price than they did before the war," unquote. Guys, is this Constitution based on a lie? Did it take a lie to get the people to accept a Constitution? Does it take a lie to get people to distance themselves? Does it take a lie to get people to wear a mask covering up their face? Does it take a lie to get people to run out and get a jab? Is government lying just a matter of being government itself? Makes one wonder, does it not?
It should make one wonder.
So
government is a lie.
Well, obviously,
it is a lie.
Obviously, for government throughout history, for government to attain its goals, it must lie to the people. Because if government did not lie to the people wouldn't accept it. Because we go back to the Hegelian dialectic. The government tells you how terrible, there's something that's just going to be really terrible, but you can depend on the government to take care of it for you. But for the government to take care of it for you requires a price. You pay with your money and your rights. You have to give up your rights for this protection. And eventually, you have neither rights nor money, and the situation just keeps getting worse. I mean, we can look at this present situation now, which I think is just classic. We've got people who took the COVID vaccine dying from COVID. It's ridiculous when you look at this. We have reached that pinnacle to where insanity rules the country. Jumping away from William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee here, but Dave, do you see a similarity?
Absolutely, and I think you made a great point earlier that once you give up enough freedom to get this so-called protection, you're not going to have either, and that's exactly where we're heading now. And of course, I believe all this insanity with COVID was deliberate. These were not a series of bad judgment calls and mistakes. This has been planned for a very long time. And it's sort of the end game, the cleanup crew to destroy what's left of freedom.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So, gosh, guys. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
It's not so much a similarity as it is just a continuation. You can go back through the whole history of the United States and find these events happening like this. I mean, how many wars has this country been lied into?
All of them.
I mean, has anybody ever come up and explained why there was a war of 1812? Is there an official narrative to what caused that war?
Well, I think I can tell you. In 1789, the government adopted the United States for 20 years. Did it run out?
The year 1811.
Oh, my.
So the next year. But you're not taught that narrative. That's the point I'm making. And there is no official narrative as to what caused that war. Because what caused it was, it was the loss of the charter of the bank. Oh, wait a minute. There was a loss of a charter of a bank right before the Constitution was created too, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. By
those same people that wrote the Constitution, who were shareholders of that very bank that lost its charter in Pennsylvania. Similarity? Just putting dots together.
Surely not. Wasn't it the Bank of North America that created the debt that brought about the call for the new Constitution?
the so-called cause. Yes, it was that debt. Oh, the who? Oh, yeah, the banksters that were here, like Robert Morris and Patrick, not Patrick Henry, Alexander Hamilton and all those cohorts. Yeah, those people, that's where the debt was owed, and they wanted to get paid. They wanted control.
So, guys, what is there an official explanation as to what caused the War of 1812? I mean, there must be some reason they've attached to it that's unrelated to banking, isn't there?
Commerce. Or not? Commerce. There
quasi,
were problems.
Somehow the quasi-war with France weighs into it. I've never figured that out.
Well, Britain was also stopping our ships and imprisoning our...
impressment, yeah.
Yeah. So that was happening, but, you know, was that intentional? Was Britain pushing for that to get the bank back in place? Because it was, essence, the Bank of England that was behind the whole thing?
Yeah, I was going to say, you mean the British that were controlled by the Bank of England? Those guys? Yeah, probably so.
Well, and you know, England's extreme reaction really shows you how important the bank was. I mean, they even burned down the White House. They actually shot cannonballs at cities, and it shows you the importance of the bank. It's a real tell as to really that's the essential foundation of control.
Absolutely. So now, let's move on, if we can, with the subject. I think we're going to jump into some more rabbit holes with this. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure of it. But let's go back to our subjects, William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee. Well, after the state conventions and the ratification of the Constitution, there were elections in some places, appointments in other states to send people to the Constitutional Convention. I mean, no, that happened. I'm sorry. I'm jumping ship here. Then there were elections to send people to the first Congress. Now, in Virginia, that turned out to be a lot of fun because everybody believed right off the bat that James Madison would be a senator from the state of Virginia because he was the father of the Constitution. But James Madison ran into this little buzzsaw known as Patrick Henry. And Patrick Henry set about doing whatever he could to ensure that James Madison was not elected senator from Virginia. And Patrick Henry also, by a double standard, not double standard, but by a double motive, wanted his two strongest anti-federalists to be those senators, and that were William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee. So through the exertions of Patrick Henry, he gets Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson elected as the senators through the state legislature. Because remember back then, before the 17th Amendment, the senators were picked by the state legislature. So Patrick Henry still had enough influence that he kept Madison out. So then the Federalists realized they have to have Madison in the first Congress.
Mike,
so then, yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but didn't you just read that in a Republican form of government that the government didn't choose who got to serve in the government?
So yep.
Being federal, that actual federal part of the federal government is actually antithetical to Republican principles.
Exactly. The more of these things...
Just wanted to point that out so everybody understands this quasi, whatever form of government you want to call it is.
Right. Dave, are we going to have the break and not hear it? Do you know? Oh, there it is. Be back on the other side, folks. Thank you.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And we'll be right back after this message.
Be evasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. And there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
If you think for one second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well,
Welcome back, folks, to Dare to Think Out Loud here in our second hour. And I am joined by Cal Robbins and Dave Scorpio. And we are discussing two people in our history that very few people know anything about. And that would be Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson. And we have been talking about them. We've been talking about republics. We have been talking about quite a few things. And I would tell you, should you have a further interest in these historical anomalies, we might say, or historical history, gained through research of authentic source documents, including thousands and thousands of letters between the people we call founders. Should you have an itch that you need to scratch in the future, please turn to my Telegram channels, which are the Rebel Madman and also Constitutional Fraud. And I post things on there almost daily, including some beautiful memes. I'm sorry, I keep mixing those two words up. Some beautiful memes that try to bring our points home to those of you who appreciate the visual as to opposed to the reading word or the read word. So we're back here and we're talking about these two people, and we got into the discussion of how in the Virginia legislature that Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson were picked by the influence of Patrick Henry to become the senators from the state of Virginia. Ironically, of the 22 senators in the first government, the very first Congress, of the 22 senators, the only two that were anti-federalist were William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee. There's another interesting fact that most people didn't know. The first two sessions of the U.S. Senate met entirely in secret. There is no record of how they voted, what they discussed, what they said when they discussed any issue. There was absolutely nothing kept because it was a totally secret enclave. So if you want to know what was going on during those first two sessions, you would be forced to go to the letters between these people or the letters these senators wrote to other people, their constituents, or to other people back in their home states. That is the only way you will know what happened. And I'll point that out again in a couple of minutes. So then what happened was, is the Federalists told Mr. Madison, hey, James, we need you in this first government, man. It's critical that we have you there. You better get on your horse or in your carriage and get out of New York and get back home to Virginia, because you must be elected to the House of Representatives now, because you're not in the Senate. So you've got to get back. So he didn't want to do that, but he did. He went back to Virginia to campaign. Well, Patrick Henry, still trying to keep as much liberty as he could in the first Congress, or proponents of liberty, he had picked James Monroe to run in that district against James Madison. Again, everything Patrick Henry was doing, he was trying to keep James Madison out of the first Congress. Unfortunately, the second move did not succeed, for James Madison was able to defeat James Monroe for that congressional seat on one principle and one principle alone. You can go back to the debates. You can look at it. You can look at the letters. James Madison would not have been elected to the first House of Representatives had Madison not promised the people of Virginia a Bill of Rights. And he knew that there was no way that he could get elected without it. So he made that the theme of his campaign was, I will bring you a Bill of Rights. You have my word. And so he then, acquiring a seat in the House of Representatives, knew as much opposition as he got, and people, he got a bunch of opposition. about even bringing up amendments at all, because the Federalists had accomplished their goals. They did not want the people to have a Bill of Rights. They voted against it unanimously at the convention. They did. They thought the, as James Wilson said, the Bill of Rights was both superfluous and absurd, and they had no need for it. And Alexander Hamilton in Federalist, I'm trying to think which one it was. It was one of the later ones, maybe 80, where he wrote a whole essay against a Bill of Rights, why it wasn't needed. So James Madison was stuck. He knew that if he did not push a Bill of Rights in the first Congress, he would not have a political future in the state of Virginia. He knew that. He had his ear to the ground. He knew that his political career was nothing if he didn't push for this Bill of Rights. So he did push for the Bill of Rights. And today people will tell you, oh, he's the father of the Constitution. He's the father of the Bill of Rights. Yeah, right. Okay, so anyway, here we have the situation as it gets to the Congress, the first Congress. And the Bill of Rights is finally brought up after a lot of objections. But if anyone wants to know the real James Madison, as far as the Bill of Rights is concerned, there is one letter that will prove the point of what James Madison was. There is one letter that he wrote on the 19th of August in 1789 to Richard Peters. And listen to this. If this doesn't show you the heart of James Madison as it deals with amendments to the Constitution, a Bill of Rights, if this doesn't illustrate to you who the man was, nothing better. And these are in his own words. This is not what somebody said about James Madison. This is what James Madison wrote to Richard Peters. And I will quote, "The papers enclosed will show here James Madison was sending papers about what was happening in Congress to another person." And he says, "The papers enclosed will show that the nauseous project of amendments," nauseous project, ooh, okay, "has not yet been either dismissed or dispatched. We are so deep in them now that right or wrong, something must be done. I say this not by way of apology, but to be sincere, I think no apology requisite. Number one, because a constitutional provision in favor of essential rights is a thing not improper in itself and was always viewed in that light by myself." Yeah, right. That's why you voted against them in the Constitutional Convention. "It may be less necessary in a republic than a monarchy and a federal government than the former, but it is in some degree rational in every government, since in every government power may oppress, and declarations on paper, though not an effectual restraint, are not without some influence." Ooh, Madison, you let the cat out of the bag here, buddy. "Declarations on paper, though not an effectual restraint." Okay. All right. Number two, "In many states, the Constitution was adopted under a tacit compact in favor of some subsequent provisions on this head. In Virginia, it would have been certainly rejected had no assurances been given by its advocates that such provisions would be pursued. As an honest man, I feel myself bound by this consideration." Yeah, okay. "If the candidates in Virginia for the House of Representatives had not taken this conciliary ground at the election, the state would have been represented almost wholly by disaffected characters instead of the Federalist reps now in Congress." Disaffected characters meant anti-Federalist people. Number four, "If amendments had not been proposed from the federal side of the House, the proposition would have come within 3 days from the adverse side. It is certainly best that they should appear to be the free gift of the friends of the Constitution, rather than to be extorted by the address and weight of its enemies. Number five, it will kill the opposition everywhere and by putting an end to the disaffection to the government itself, enable the administration to venture on measures not otherwise safe. To those who hate this government will always join the party disaffected to measures of the administration, and such a party will be created by every important measure. Six, if no amendments be proposed, the language of the anti-federalist leaders to the people will be, we advised you not to adopt this Constitution without previous amendments. You listened to those who told you that subsequent securities for your rights would be most easily obtained. We urged you to insist on a convention as the only effectual mode of obtaining these. You yielded to the assurances of those who told you that a convention was unnecessary, that Congress would be the proper channel for getting what was wanted, etc., etc. Here are fine texts for proper declaimers who wish to revive the anti-federalist cause, and at the fall session of the legislatures to blow the trumpet for a second convention. In Virginia, a majority of the legislature last elected is bitterly opposed to the government and will be joined if no amendments be proposed by great numbers of the other side who will complain of being deceived. Number seven, some amendments are necessary for North Carolina. I am so informed by the best authorities in that state. Now, folks, North Carolina and Rhode Island still hadn't ratified the Constitution, so they were outside. So here James Madison is telling Richard Peters that they need to add them. This letter proves beyond a shadow of a doubt the deceitfulness of James Madison in the amendments. Because in the very first sentence, he called it a nauseous project. And then he also says in there that declarations on paper are not enforceable. Enforceable is my word. But that's what he's saying. Just because there's declarations on paper doesn't mean the people are going to get them. Yeah, think about that one, guys. Cal, you got any comments there, my friend?
Well, just one thing. The opposition that Madison faced in proposing amendments came from his fellow Federalists. They were the ones opposed to amendments. His work was to convince his fellow conspiracy guys who conspired to create this criminal conspiracy called the Constitution that it's in their best interest that we pass these amendments. And I believe it was number four. He's explaining that, well, he's just being the best way to control the opposition is to lead the opposition. And that's exactly what he did in proposing the amendments. They're toothless. They're meaningless.
Exactly.
As he said, they don't, they're just words on paper. They do have some salutary effect. I mean, they are a reminder that, hey, guys, you do have rights. But other than that, if people don't take those, you know, those rights to their heart and carry them within them instead of on paper, the rights are meaningless.
Well, you know, when people now tell me they have rights, I say, okay, let me see you enforce them. If you've got them, enforce them. But here, jumping again, we can get on to that one. But jumping again, about this same period of time, Patrick Henry back in Virginia writes a letter to Senator Richard Henry Lee about the amendments. And here's what Mr. Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death has to say. He says, as to my opinion of the amendments, I think that they will tend to injure rather than to serve the cause of liberty, provided they go no further than is proposed as ideas. For what good end can be answered by these rights, the tenure of which must be during pleasure? For rights without her power and might is but a shadow. There, Patrick Henry says, if you have them written on paper, without the power to enforce them, without the might to enforce them, they are but a shadow. Now, continuing with what Patrick Henry says, he says, now it seems that it is not proposed to add this force to the right by any amendment, and it wasn't. It can therefore answer no purpose but to lull suspicion totally on the subject. In other words, if people think they have some rights, they will sit pacified in their chairs and do nothing. Then he says,
Mike, not only will do nothing, Madison points out that if we pass these rights, we'll be able to get away with stuff we wouldn't normally be able to get away with.
Exactly.
They intend on intruding, but if people think they're secure in their rights, hey, the people will go along with it. They will accept a lot more tyranny if they think they have their rights.
How did Jonathan Swift describe that? A tub to the whale?
Exactly. That's exactly what they are. People play with their rights as the harpoon of tyranny is repeatedly inserted into them.
To continue with Patrick Henry, while impediments are cast in the way of those who wish to retrench the exorbitancy of power granted away by the Constitution from the people, a fresh grant from them is made in the most moment of opportunity and of a nature and extent to which full success in the business of amendments would scarcely compensate. I mean the uncontrolled power of the president over all the officers. So what do you think of that, Cal?
He's just explaining what's going on. Things are the way they are right now because they were designed to be this way. The president was supposed to be, through the Constitution, act like a king eventually. You know, it just takes time for the people to acquiesce to it, and pretty soon... basically, the Constitution worked out better for the Federalists than they even anticipated, in my view.
Well, I think you're right. And all they had to do was throw a tub to the whale to get the other people to just shut up and go along with the fraud.
Well, it did. There had already been a petition in Congress, to the Congress, from the state of Virginia, as Madison pointed out, that people, the legislature of Virginia hated the new government. But Virginia and New York had already sent a petition calling for an Article 5 convention. There were already clamors from the two major states calling for a new convention. And Madison wanted to shut that down. He was trying to explain to his fellow Federalists, we got to shut it down or we might go into a new convention and we're going to lose all these gains we've made. That's what he was selling to the Federalists. That's what the Bill of Rights is actually all about. It's not about securing people's liberty. It's about silencing dissent.
Well stated. Well, now let's look at, like I said previously, we don't know what the Senate did with these Bill of Rights that went up from the House of Representatives. Plus, we don't know what the committee that was appointed by James Madison, we don't know how that committee whittled down 100 or more proposed amendments, 200, but when they reduced or did away with duplicates, there were still a little over 100 suggested amendments for a Bill of Rights. And the committee that was appointed by James Madison, of all Federalists, they went through those 100 suggested amendments and whittled them down to 14. Well, now why? Who gave them the power to decide that these amendments that the people had offered to the government, that proves right away that this was not a government of we the people, because we the people's amendments were thrown in the trash can by this first government. And they threw away anything that would restrict the government's authority over the people. I promise you they did. And the one that they threw away that every state recommended was no direct taxation shall ever be placed on the people. That was submitted by every state, and it was thrown out. Imagine that. But let's look. Let's look at some actual words from Richard Henry Lee to Patrick Henry on September the 14th of 1789. As the Senate has just looked at these new amendments. So it says, Richard Henry Lee to Patrick Henry, and I quote, I have since waited to see the issue of the proposed amendments to the Constitution that I might give you the most exact account of that business. As they came from the House of Representatives, they were very far short of the wishes of our convention. He's talking about the State Convention of Virginia. But as they are returned by the Senate, they are certainly much weakened. So here, Richard Henry Lee is saying not only did the House of Representatives leave them far short of what our state recommended, but they are even further weakened by this Senate. He then says, "You may be assured that nothing on my part was left undone to prevent this, and every possible effort was used to give success to all the amendments proposed by our country. We might as well have attempted to move Mount Atlas upon our shoulders. In fact, the idea of subsequent amendments was delusion altogether, and so intended by the greater part of those who arrogated to themselves the name of Federalists. I am grieved to see that too many look at the rights of the people as a miser examines a security to find a flaw in it. The great points of free election, jury trial, and criminal cases have been much loosened. The unlimited right of taxation and standing armies in peacetime remain as they were. Some valuable rights are indeed declared, but the powers that remain are very sufficient to render them nugatory at pleasure." What a sentence. "Some valuable rights are indeed declared." Second Amendment, people. Fourth Amendment, people. Tenth Amendment, people. "Some valuable rights are indeed declared, but the powers that remain in this Constitution are very sufficient to render them nugatory at pleasure." Damn, that ought to be chiseled in stone somewhere. "The most essential danger from the present system arises, in my opinion, from its tendency to a consolidated government instead of a union of confederated states. The history of the world and reason concurs in proving that so extensive a territory as the United States comprehend never was or can be governed in freedom under the former idea. Under the latter, it is abundantly more practicable," talking about the Articles of Confederation, "because extended representation, knowledge of character, and confidence in consequence are wanting to sway the opinion of rulers, without which fear the offspring of tyranny can alone answer. Hence, standing armies and despotism follows. I take this reasoning to be unrefutable, and therefore it becomes the friends of liberty to guard with perfect vigilance every right that belongs to the states and to protest against every invasion of them, taking care always to procure as many protesting states as possible. This kind of vigilance will create caution and probably establish such a mode of conduct as will create a system of precedent that will prevent a consolidating effect from taking place by slow but sure degrees." Unfortunately, that didn't happen. "And also not to cease in renewing their efforts for so amending the federal Constitution as to prevent a consolidation by securing the due authority of the states. At present, perhaps a sufficient number of legislatures cannot be got to agree in demanding a new convention, but I shall be much mistaken if a great sufficiency will not ere long concur in this measure." Again, he was not correct. "The preamble to the amendments is really curious. A careless reader would apt to suppose that the amendments desired by the states had been graciously granted. But when the thing done is compared with that which was desired, nothing can be more unlike. By comparing the Senate amendments with those from below, by carefully attending to the matter, The former will appear well calculated to enfeeble and produce ambiguity. For instance, 10th Amendment, people, listen to this. For instance, rights reserved to the states of the people or the people. The people here is evidently designed for the people of the United States in aggregate, not of the individual states. The former in the constitutional idea of the people, we the people, etc. It was affirmed the rights reserved by the state's Bill of Rights did not belong to the states. Ooh. I observed that then they belonged to the people of the states, but that mode of expressing was evidently calculated to give the residuum to the people of the United States, which was the constitutional language, and to deny it to the people of the individual states. At least that it left room for cavil and false construction. They would not insert after people thereof, though I moved for it. The Senate purposely perverted the 10th Amendment. Right here's the evidence. And Richard Henry Lee moved that they put in there after the people thereof the states. He wanted to clarify that when it gets to the 10th Amendment and it says to the states or to the people, when it says or to the people, the Senate made that or to the people of all the other states, not to the people of that individual state. And these people who claim the 10th Amendment and don't know this are deluding you and other people. I promise you. Here in this letter, Richard Henry Lee lays it out exactly what happened, because there are no records of how the Senate handled this, because they met in secret. Cal, you got any comments?
Are you there, Mike?
Yeah, I'm talking, but I get nothing back.
Oh, sorry about that. Hey, I was on mute. Sorry. My bad. He's talking about the 10th Amendment, and I've never heard that part where he wanted to add thereof. So I was just going back to the 10th Amendment and inserting that into the text for myself to see how it would read. It would be the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people thereof. And he had proposed it, and apparently, as you say, you know, we don't have the proceedings from the Senate. He had proposed that would be inserted into it, and I guess it was rejected. And yeah, that does change the meaning of the, you know, of who the people of. It's talking about the people of the states, not the people of the United States.
Well, so that is exactly. It was such a fraud.
That's just as big as, you know, as understanding how the word expressly, you know, the powers not expressly delegated to the United States was removed by the House.
Well, here again,
big. I mean, put that back together. Let's say those two things were in the 10th Amendment. It would have read the powers not expressly delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people thereof. That almost changes the whole 10th Amendment.
It would.
Just those two words. And yeah, the Federalists in their craftiness got those words excluded.
Okay, let me go back to this sentence. And this, I think, is critical. It was affirmed that the rights reserved by the states' bills of rights do not belong to the states. I observed that then they belong to the people of the states, but that this mode of expressing was evidently calculated to give the residuum to the people of the United States, which was the constitutional language, and to deny it to the people of the individual states. Here, the massive fraud is totally turned upside down of the 10th Amendment. It's, to me, it's almost, and yet, Do we ever hear, maybe that's one of the reasons nobody knows anything about Richard Henry Lee. Because he revealed the fraud right there. And then later, Richard Henry Lee would write to Patrick Henry a week later. And he says, my third letter to you on the 14th instant will satisfy you how little is to be expected from Congress that shall be in any ways satisfactory on the subject of amendments. Your observation is perfectly just that the right without power to protect it is of no avail. Yet small as it is, how wonderfully scrupulous have they been in stating rights. The English language has been carefully culled to find words feeble in their nature, or at least doubtful in their meaning. By an address received 2 days ago from the Assembly of Rhode Island, copy of which I will send to you by my brother to the federal government, it appears to me as if they intended to keep out of the Union until effectual amendments were made. We ought to have, in common prudence, to have done the same thing. Is North Carolina designed to act in the same manner? So here, Richard Henry Lee also covers the fraud. And then let's go to Mr. Grayson's letter to Patrick Henry in late September of 1789. And here is what he says. He says, and I quote, "With respect to amendments, matters have turned out exactly as I apprehended from the extraordinary doctrine of playing the after game." In other words, adding amendments after the Constitution. "The lower house sent up amendments which held out a limited safeguard to personal liberty in a great many instances, but this disgusted the Senate. And though we made every exertion to save them, they are so mutilated and gutted that in fact they are good for nothing. And I believe, as many others do, that they will do more harm than benefit. The Virginia amendments were all brought into view and regularly rejected. Perhaps they may think differently on the subject the next session." Well, we know that didn't happen. Here is a very, this I think most people don't know. And if you don't get into these letters, you didn't know this. Even though the House of Representatives had culled those amendments down to 14, and sent them to the Senate. Even though they had culled them, when they got it to the Senate, Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson brought up every darn amendment that their state had offered. And again, there's no records, but we have to go by these letters. And here William Grayson repeats, "The Virginia amendments were all brought into view, but regularly rejected by a Senate that held a majority of 20-2. They didn't have a chance in the Senate. The Bill of Rights didn't have a chance in that Senate, and we are never taught this. Didn't have a chance at all. These letters prove it unequivocally." Now, to move a little further before we run short on time. There was an address by Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson to the Speaker of the Virginia House of Delegates. And here it is to them, that what they sent. "We have now the honor of enclosing the propositions of amendments to the Constitution of the United States that have been finally agreed upon by Congress. We can assure you, sir, that nothing on our part has been omitted to procure the success of those considered radical amendments proposed by the convention and approved by the legislature of our country, which, as our constituent, we shall always deem it our duty with respect and reverence to obey. The journal of the Senate herewith transmitted will at once show how exact and how unfortunate we have been in this business. It is impossible for us not to see the necessary tendency to consolidate empire in the natural operation of the Constitution if it is no further amended than now proposed. And it is equally impossible for us not to be apprehensive for civil liberty when we know no instance in the records of history that show a people ruled in freedom when subject to an undivided government and inhabiting a territory so extensive as that of the United States, and when, as it seems to us, the nature of man and things join to prevent it. The impracticability in such case of carrying representation sufficiently near to the people for procuring their confidence and consequent obedience compels a resort to fear resulting from great force and excessive power in our government. Confederated Republics, when the federal hand is not possessed of absorbing power, may permit the existence of freedom, while it preserves union strength and safety. Such amendments, therefore, as may secure against the annihilation of the state government, we devoutly wish to see adopted. In a preserving application to Congress from the states that have desired such amendments should fail of its object, we are disposed to think, reasoning from causes to effects, that unless a dangerous apathy should invade the public mind, it will not be many years before a constitutional number of legislatures will be found to demand a convention for the purpose. Unfortunately, they were wrong, but his prepositionary clause to his sentence nails it. Unless a dangerous apathy should invade the public mind. And that is exactly what we have today, gentlemen. Dave, you got any thoughts, my friend?
No, I just think you're spot on, Mike. You're destroying a lot of old illusions that are quite obvious once you see them.
Well, one of the things that gets to me, one of the things I was thinking of as I was reading Richard Henry Lee's letter to Patrick Henry, was his statement that, some of the statements he made, and we never hear those quoted. We've never heard that quoted where he said we didn't have a republic, where this was not a republican form of government. We never hear that quoted. I've never heard it quoted anywhere. And yet, how many times have we heard Benjamin Franklin, oh, you have a republic if you can keep it? Hell no, we didn't have a republic. Benjamin Franklin wasn't at the in the first Congress. And he certainly wasn't part of creating one in the convention. That was not a republic. But people today presume that it was. Cal, your comment, sir?
Well, in studying all this, one of the things I've come to understand that even some of the Federalists weren't so sure that even this Constitution would last. Franklin even said it, it's a republic if you can keep it. So he had his doubts on how long even this form of government would last. So, to give credit to Madison in crafting this Constitution and what it's accomplished in the ways of tyranny, if you want that, you got to take your hat off and admire him for what he accomplished. It's not a good thing to say, but yeah, this Constitution has succeeded beyond the hopes of Hamilton or Madison. In just my perspective in looking at it, I mean, they wrote to each other thinking that this form of government wouldn't last. Washington, he said, hey, if this doesn't last, by then the people will be ready to accept the monarchy again. I mean, those are in letters he's wrote. Others wrote the same thing. So even to some of the Federalists, this government was only going to be a temporary step on the way to back to a monarchy. But they've discovered that, well, we don't really need a monarchy because we have all the powers of a monarchy buried in this oligarchy, and the people seem to be liking it. So let's just keep rolling with what works, Let's keep running the play that they got until they figure out how to stop it.
Well, I think one of the really neat letters among these people was the letter from Robert Morris, who was one of the public defrauders, who was also in the Senate, and there was no way in hell he was going to vote for any of these amendments. But Robert Morris, in a letter to Francis Hopkinson, when they were talking about the amendments, and he said, if they pass the right amendment, I will hang. I always thought that one, well, he probably the most truthful he had ever been, because if all of his fraud of the government that led to all of this terrible indebtedness that they were clamoring to have unlimited taxation to secure for themselves, you know, what kind of mess would that have been?
Well, you can add into it, you know, Hamilton's opinion on the, you know, the amendments that were passed and ratified, you know, where he says it is because the amendments subsequently made, meeting scarcely any of the important objections which were urged, leaving the structure of the government and the mass and distribution of its powers where they were, are too insignificant to be, with any sensible man, a reason for being reconciled to the system if he thought it was originally bad. In other words, you know, these guys wanted these amendments passed, and yeah, they got their amendments, but it didn't change anything, and we still have all the powers that we wanted. So that was Hamilton's opinion of it, of the whole matter on amendments.
Exactly. So how, you know, is there any way, guys, you guys believe there's any way at all that this system, that the people will ever catch on to how much they've been defrauded?
No, they love their gilded chains of slavery and servitude. They're forged them themselves, so.
Well, I do think we're hitting a point of critical mass soon. I think it's becoming more and more apparent to the average Bubba's Americanus, as you call them, that something's seriously wrong. And as things get more insane and more crazy, I think more and more people are going to realize that we can't continue on this trajectory. At least I hope so.
Well, here is, I thought this was amazing, though, but some of the people, and this is one of the reasons I keep doing this, Dave, is some of the people that I see who are awakening will still latch onto the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and say, oh, if we can use this against them. No, you can't. There's nothing there to use against them. I wish I was wrong. Gosh, I wish I was. But, you know, earlier, I just wanted to mention this. I should have read this earlier, but I didn't. But we remember that letter, if you want to know the fraud, where James Madison wrote to Richard Peters and said that there was, the onerous business, or this ugly business of amendments, which he admitted to Richard Peters. I should have read Richard Peters' letter to Madison earlier, while Madison was, in the House of Representatives before the amendments, or it just came up. And here was what Richard Peters wrote to James Madison. He said, I see you have been offering amendments to the machine before it is known whether it wants any. After these shall be added, the ingenuity of those who wish to embarrass its motions will find out some things that it wants. And so after making it as complicated as a combination of Dutch stocking looms, they will allege it to be too intricate for use. I was glad on one account to observe you were not joined by these great artists who offer repairs before the thing is torn, but I was mortified on the other hand that you were in a situation to put it in their power to neglect you. Pardon me. You must not be hurt at these clodhopping sentiments of mine, for I love you so truly that I dislike your mixing with so many parts of your conduct that command my approbation. Any one I cannot praise. You see into what a scrape you have brought yourself by being kind to me. Yet it is more than possible I am wrong in all this business, as you know more of the necessity of such accommodations than I do. If chips must be placed into the porridge, however, I think I would let the bad cooks put them into the pot. Nor should any throw out tubs but those who are afraid of the whale. Does this guy sound like he's telling Madison what he ought to do? And believe me, when you get into these letters, you will find a whole plethora of letters excoriating Madison for even bringing up amendments. But then if you go to the letters of William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee, you will see that the amendments were neutered before they were ever passed. What do you think, Cal?
Okay, that letter was written by Richard Peters, right?
Yes.
And the name's familiar. Who is Richard Peters?
Well, he was a member of the Congress. He was a captain in the Revolutionary War, and he became a federal judge. Imagine that.
Okay. What state was he from? Virginia? You there?
Oh, pardon me. I had to cough. Right offhand, I don't know. I think he was from Pennsylvania, though, but I'm not positive on that.
Okay. Just through the research, the name is familiar, and I was... Oh, here he is. He's on my list of shareholders. Ah. I knew the name was familiar. There he is. He's on the list of shareholders of the original Bank of North America. There we go.
Oh, he's one of the people that Robert Morris loaned money to.
He's one of those people that were defrauding the American people. Yeah, him.
Oh, okay.
I knew the name was familiar. So, there we go.
Well, how interesting that he was one of the defrauders. He was holding debt. And just for those of you who might be tuning in, Robert Morris started the Bank of North America, and he embezzled something over $270,000 out of the funds which France had loaned to the United States. And he loaned that money out to people like Richard Peters so they could buy stock in the Bank of North America. And then he took that money and then loaned it to the United States so the United States government would then have to pay interest on that money twice. Once to the stockholders and then to France. So maybe some of these financial problems that the Federalists were talking about were the financial problems that were created by Mr. Morris himself. Would I be wrong in that assessment, Cal?
No, you'd be 100% accurate. Those were the only financial problems. The foreign debt was being handled. It was being paid. Holland was willing to lend money again. It's like, hey, we made money on them first time. They're good for it. Let's lend them some more. So, yeah, no, the problem of the debt was the domestic debt owed to the Bank of North America, the shareholders of North America. I did notice one thing, and they started to call themselves the memorialists. They started to refer to themselves as the memorialists. I mean, I've run across that name, and it always has to do with paying somebody that had something to do with the industrial military complex that existed back then, and the banksters. The bankers of the North America then, and they started referring to themselves as memorialists, almost as if it was code that we're the memorialists and you owe us money. Kind of like we're the mob and you owe us money, or Guido's going to come break your leg.
Oh, how sweet. How very, very sweet, huh? Was that not good? So, we're dealing with, I don't know how anyone can claim to be knowledgeable of history if they haven't read these letters, guys, because here's where the history is. This is exactly where the history is.
Hey, Mike.
Yes, sir.
Because we're running out of time before we go, it is July 2nd, and this is officially the day that the Continental Congress agreed to the Lee Resolution and actually declared independence.
Say that again, please, Cal. I'm sorry.
Okay. It was July 2nd, 1776. When the Continental Congress agreed to the Lee Resolution, which was them declaring independence from Great Britain. So the real declaration the first original Declaration of Independence was actually on this date, not July 4th. That's when they adopted the official Declaration of Independence drafted by the Committee of Five. But 2 days before, they had adopted the revised version of Richard Henry Lee's resolution declaring that the states are ought to be independent and free and sovereign.
Yep. So we
today,
are.
Today is actually the true Independence Day.
So we are coming upon the nation's birthday. And we should also make note that shortly thereafter, 1776 to 1787, it took that long. We actually lived in a country with a semblance of liberty and freedom for, 20 years? No, 10 years. Wow. Before the monarchists took the government back again and created a government that was worse than the government under King George, and today people think it was sent by God. Ignorance is bliss.
I would question if July 2nd or July 4th is actually the birth of this nation. This nation wasn't created until the Constitution was ratified.
1781.
Yeah. So
the one we're under now?
The Declaration of Independence, one, it didn't create any government, and the government that evolved from that declaration was the Articles of Confederation, which actually created 13 separate sovereign nations.
Right.
So, actually, July 4th is not the birthday of this nation, or July 2nd.
It's the birth
of independence.
Well, we're about to run out of time here, so folks, I would like to remind you of my two Telegram channels, Rebel Madman and Constitutional Fraud. Come over and join us, please. We discuss these things on almost a daily basis. Look forward to having you there. Dave, what have you got planned for tomorrow, my friend?
Well, I'm going to have two different guests on. I'm going to have Gertchen from Canada, and I'm going to have a guy, Stephen Kelly, from Los Angeles area, talking about some interesting things going on inside the deep state.
Oh, interesting. Well, I'll do my best to tune in there, my friend. I look forward to that. Cal, what's going on in Arizona?
We're just, like I said, it's just cooling down. It's only going to be about 115 today, so it'd be a nice day to go out and get a suntan.
Oh, absolutely sure. Probably take 15 or 20 seconds, huh?
Yeah, go rotisserie, bake myself in a half hour. Yep.
Well, it looks like here in the state of Georgia, we're about to get some terrible thunderstorms. But anyway, folks, thank you so much for tuning in to Dare to Think Out Loud. Thanks, Cal. Thanks, Dave, appreciate you guys. Thank Revolution Radio. Thank you for the platform on which to speak. We appreciate everyone, and we look forward to seeing you all next week.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Zero 5173. We talk about decentralization and